Hello, and welcome to Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, the podcast. Written by Eliezer Yudkowsky, read by Ignaz Brodsky, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. First half of Chapter 7, Reciprocation. Petunia Evans Varys' lips were trembling, and her eyes were tearing up as Harry hugged her midsection on Platform 9 of the King's Cross Station. "Are you sure you don't want me to come with you, Harry?" Harry looked up at her. His eyes glanced over to his father, Michael Varys Evans, who was looking stereotypically stern but proud, and then back to his mother, who really did look rather uncomposed. "Mom, I know you don't like the wizarding world very much. You don't have to come with. I mean it." Petunia winced. "Harry, you shouldn't worry about me. I'm your mother, and if you need someone with you..." "Mom, I'm going to be on my own at Hogwarts for months and months. If I can't manage a train platform alone, better to find out sooner rather than later so we can abort." He lowered his voice to a whisper. "Besides, Mom, they all love me over there. If I have any problems, all I need to do is take off my headband..." Harry tapped the exercise sweatband covering his scar. "And I'll have way more help than I can handle." "Oh, Harry," Petunia whispered. She knelt down and hugged him hard, face to face, their cheeks resting against each other. Harry could feel her ragged breathing, and then he heard a sob escape her lips, choked and muffled, but there. "Oh, Harry, I do love you. Always remember that." "It's like she's afraid she'll never see me again," the thought suddenly popped into Harry's head. He knew the thought was true, but he didn't know why Mum was so afraid. So he made a guess. "Mum, you know that I'm not going to turn into your sister just because I'm learning magic, right? I'll do any magic you ask for, if I can, I mean. Or if you want me not to use magic around the house, I'll do that too. I promise I'll never let magic come between us." A tight hug cut off his words. "You have a good heart," his mother whispered into his ear. "A very good heart, my son." Harry choked up himself a little then. His mother released him and stood up. She took a handkerchief out of her pocket and dabbed at her eyes and running makeup with a trembling hand. There were no questions about his father accompanying him to the magical side of King's Cross Station. Dad had trouble just looking at Harry's trunk directly. Magic ran in families, and Michael Varys Evans couldn't even walk. So instead, his father just cleared his throat.
"Good luck at school, Harry," he said. "Do you think I bought you enough books?"
Harry had explained to his father about how he thought this might be his big chance to do something really revolutionary and important, and Professor Varys Evans had nodded and dumped his extremely busy schedule for 2 solid days in order to go on the greatest used bookstore raid ever, which had covered 4 cities and produced 30 boxes of science books, now sitting in the cavern level of Harry's trunk. Most of the books had gone for £1 or £2, but some of them definitely hadn't, like the very latest Handbook of Chemistry and Physics, or the complete 1972 set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. His father had tried to block Harry off from seeing the price registers, but Harry figured his father must have spent at least £1,000. Harry had said to his father that he would pay him back as soon as he figured out how to convert wizarding gold into muggle money, and his father had told him to go jump in a lake. And then his father had asked him, "Do you think I bought you enough books?" It was very clear what answer Dad was looking for. Harry's throat was hoarse for some reason. "You can never have enough books," he recited the Varys family motto, and his father knelt down and gave him a quick, firm embrace. "But you certainly tried," Harry said, and felt himself choking up again. "It was a really, really, really good try." His dad straightened.
"So," he said, "do you see a Platform 9¾?
King's Cross Station was huge and busy, the walls and floor paved with ordinary dirt-stained tiles, full of ordinary people hurrying about their ordinary business and having ordinary conversations that generated lots and lots of ordinary noise. King's Cross Station had a Platform 9, which they were standing on, and a Platform 10, right nearby, but there was absolutely nothing between Platform 9 and Platform 10 except a thin, unpromising barrier wall. A great skylight overhead let in plenty of light to illuminate the total lack whatsoever of any Platform 9¾. Harry stared around until his eyes watered, thinking, "Come on, Mage Sight! Come on, Mage Sight!" But absolutely nothing appeared to him. He thought about taking out his wand and waving it, but McGonagall had warned him against using his wand. Plus, if there was another shower of multicolored sparks, that might lead to being arrested for setting off fireworks inside a train station. And that was assuming his wand didn't decide to do something else, like blowing up all of King's Cross. Harry had only lightly skimmed his schoolbooks, though that skim was quite bizarre enough, in a very quick effort to determine what sort of science books to buy over the next 48 hours. Well, he had, Harry glanced at his watch, 1 whole hour to figure it out, since he was supposed to be on the train at 11.
Maybe this was the equivalent of an IQ test and the dumb kids couldn't become wizards. And the amount of extra time you gave yourself would determine your conscientiousness, which was the second most important factor in scholarly success. I'll figure it out, Harry said to his waiting parents. It's probably some sort of test thingy. His father frowned.
Maybe look for a trail of mixed footprints on the ground, leading somewhere that doesn't seem to make sense.
Dad, Harry said, stop that! I haven't even tried to figure it out on my own. It was a very good suggestion, too, which was worse.
Sorry, his father apologized.
Harry's mother said, I don't think they would do that to a student, do you? Are you sure Professor McGonagall didn't tell you anything?
Maybe she was distracted, Harry said, without thinking about it.
Harry,
hissed his father and mother in unison, what did you do?
Harry swallowed. Look, we don't have time for this now.
Harry?
I mean it. We don't have time for this now, because it's a really long story, and I've got to figure out how to get to school.
His mother had a hand over her face. How bad was it?
I can't talk about that for reasons of national security. About half as bad as the incident with the science fair project?
Harry!
Look, there's some people with an owl. I'll go ask them how to get in.
And Harry ran away from his parents toward the family of fiery redheads, his trunk automatically slithering behind him. The plump woman looked up toward him as he arrived.
Hello, dear. First time at Hogwarts. Ron's new, too.
And then she froze. She peered closely at him.
Harry Potter?
Four boys and a redheaded girl and an owl all swung around and also froze in place.
Oh, come on,
Harry protested. He'd been planning to go by Mr. Varys at least until he got to Hogwarts.
I bought a headband and everything. How come you know who I am?
Yes, Harry's father said, coming up behind him with long, easy strides. How do you know who he is? His voice indicated a certain dread.
Your picture was in the newspapers, said one of two identical-looking twins.
Harry!
Dad, it's not like that. It's 'cause I defeated Dark Lord You-Know-Who when I was 1 year old.
What?
Mum can explain.
What?
Michael, dear, there are certain things I thought it would be best not to bother you with until now.
Excuse me, Harry said to the red-headed family who were all staring at him, but it would be quite extremely helpful if you could tell me how to get to platform 9 3/4 right now.
Ah, said the woman.
She raised a hand and pointed at the wall between platforms.
Just walk straight at the barrier between platforms 9 and 10. Don't stop, and don't be scared you'll crash into it. That's very important. Best do it at a bit of a run if you're nervous.
And whatever you do, don't think of an elephant.
George! Ignore him, Harry dear. There's no reason not to think of an elephant.
I'm Fred, Mum, not George.
Thanks,
Harry said, and took off at a run toward the barrier.
Wait a minute. It wouldn't work unless he believed in it.
It was at times like this that Harry hated his mind for actually working fast enough to realize that this was a case where resonant doubt applied. That is, if he'd started out thinking that he would go through the barrier, he'd have been fine. Only now he was worried about whether he sufficiently believed he'd go through the barrier, which meant he actually was worried about crashing into it.
Harry! Get back here! You have some explaining to do!
That was his dad. Harry shut his eyes and ignored everything he knew about justified belief and just tried to believe really hard that he'd go through the barrier and... The sounds around him changed. Harry opened his eyes and stumbled to a halt, feeling vaguely dirtied by having made a deliberate effort to believe something. He was standing in a bright, open-air platform next to a single huge train. 14 long cars headed up by a massive scarlet metal steam engine with a smokestack that promised death to air quality. The platform was already lightly crowded, even though Harry was a full hour early, and dozens of children and their parents were swarming around benches, tables, and various hawkers and vendors. It went completely without saying that there was no such place in King's Cross Station and no room to hide it. Okay, so either A, I just teleported somewhere else entirely, B, they can fold space like no one's business, or C, they are simply ignoring the rules. There was a slithering sound behind him, and Harry turned to confirm that his trunk had indeed followed him on its small clawed tentacles. Apparently, for magical purposes, his luggage had also managed to believe with sufficient strength to pass through the barrier. Actually, that was quite disturbing when Harry started thinking about it. A moment later, the youngest-looking red-haired boy came through the iron archway.
Iron archway? at a run, pulling his trunk behind him on a leash and nearly crashing into Harry. Harry, feeling stupid for having stayed around, quickly began moving away from the landing area, and the red-haired boy followed him, yanking hard on his trunk's leash in order to keep up. A moment later, a white owl fluttered through the archway and came to rest on the boy's shoulder.
"Cor," said the red-haired boy, "are you really Harry Potter?"
"Not this again."
"I have no logical way of knowing that for certain. My parents raised me to believe that I was Harry Potter, and many people here have told me I look like my parents. I mean, my other parents. But..." Harry frowned, realizing. "For all I know, there could easily be spells to polymorph a child into a specified appearance."
What, mate? Not headed for Ravenclaw, I take it."
"Yes, I'm Harry Potter."
"I'm Ron Weasley,"
said the tall, skinny, freckled, long-nosed kid, and stuck out a hand, which Harry politely shook as they walked. The owl gave Harry an oddly measured and courteous hoot, actually more of an sound, which surprised Harry. At this point, Harry realized the potential for imminent catastrophe and devised a way to prevent it. "Just a second," he said to Ron, and opened one of the drawers of his trunk, the one that, if he recalled correctly, was for winter clothes, and then he found the lightest scarf he owned underneath his winter coat. Harry took off his headband and just as quickly unfolded the scarf and tied it around his face. It was a little hot, especially in the summer, but Harry could live with that. Then he shut the drawer, now containing his useless headband, though it didn't really belong there, and pulled out another drawer and drew forth his black wizard robes, which he shrugged over his head now that he was out of Muggle territory. "There," Harry said, satisfied. The sound came out only slightly muffled through the scarf over his face. He turned to Ron. "How do I look? Stupid, I know. But am I identifiable as Harry Potter?"
Ron said. He closed his mouth, which had been open. "Not really, Harry."
"Very good," Harry said. "However, so as not to obviate the point of the whole exercise, you will henceforth address me as..." Varys might not work anymore. "Mr. Spoo."
"Okay, Harry," Ron said uncertainly.
"The force is not particularly strong in this one."
"Call me Mr. Spoo."
"Okay, Mr. Spoo," Ron said.
Ron stopped.
"I can't do that. It makes me feel stupid."
"That's not just a feeling."
"Okay, you pick a name."
"Mr. Cannon," Ron said at once. "For the Chudley Cannons."
Ah. Harry had a dire apprehension that he was going to terribly regret asking this. "Who or what are the Chudley Cannons?"
"Who are the Chudley Cannons? Only the most brilliant team in the whole history of Quidditch. Sure, they finished at the bottom of the league last year, but..."
"What's Quidditch?" Asking this was also a mistake. "So, let me get this straight," Harry said, as it seemed that Ron's explanation, with associated hand gestures, was winding down. "Catching the snitch is worth 150 points."
"Yeah."
"How many 10-point goals does one side usually score, not counting the snitch?"
Maybe 15 or 20 in professional games."
"That's just wrong. That violates every possible rule of game design. Look, the rest of this game sounds like it might make sense, sort of, for a sport I mean, but you're basically saying that catching the snitch overwhelms almost any ordinary point spread. The two Seekers are up there, flying around looking for the snitch and usually not interacting with anyone else. Spotting the snitch first is going to be mostly luck."
"It's not luck," protested Ron. "You've got to keep your eyes moving in the right pattern."
"That's not interactive. There's no back and forth with the other players. And how much fun is it to watch someone incredibly good at moving their eyes? And then whichever Seeker gets lucky swoops in and grabs the snitch and makes everyone else's work moot. It's like someone took a real game and grafted on this pointless extra position just so that you could be the most important player without needing to really get involved or learn the rest of it. Who was the first Seeker? The king's idiot son who wanted to play Quidditch but couldn't understand the rules?" Actually, now that Harry thought about it, that seemed like a surprisingly good hypothesis. "Put him on a broomstick and tell him to catch the shiny thing." Ron's face pulled into a scowl.
"If you don't like Quidditch, you don't have to make fun of it."
"If you can't criticize, you can't optimize. I'm suggesting how to improve the game. And it's very simple. Get rid of the snitch."
"They won't change the game just because you say so."
"I am the boy who lived, you know. People will listen to me. And maybe if I can persuade them to change the game at Hogwarts, the innovation will spread." A look of absolute horror was spreading over Ron's face.
But if you get rid of the snitch, how will anyone know when the game ends?"
"By a clock," It would be a lot fairer than having the game sometimes end after 10 minutes and sometimes not end for hours. And the schedule would be a lot more predictable for the spectators, too. Harry sighed. Oh, stop giving me that look of absolute horror. I probably won't actually take the time to destroy this pathetic excuse for national sport and remake it stronger and smarter in my own image. I've got way, way, way more important stuff to worry about. Harry looked thoughtful. Then again, it wouldn't take much time to write up a 95 theses of the snitchless reformation and nail it to a church door.
Potter, drawled a young boy's voice. What is that on your face, and what is standing next to you?
Ron's look of horror was replaced by utter hatred.
You!
Harry turned his head, and indeed it was Draco Malfoy, who might have been forced to wear standard school robes, but was making up for that with a trunk looking at least as magical and far more elegant than Harry's own, decorated in silver and emeralds and bearing what Harry guessed to be the Malfoy family crest, a beautiful fanged serpent over crossed ivory wands.
Draco! Harry said. Or Malfoy if you prefer. Though that kind of sounds like Lucius to me. I'm glad to see you're doing so well after, our last meeting.
This is Ron Weasley, and I'm trying to go incognito, so call me, Harry looked down at his robes.
Mr. Black. Harry, hissed Ron. You can't use that name.
Harry blinked.
Why not?
It sounded nicely dark, like an international man of mystery.
I'd say it's a fine name, said Draco. But the noble and most ancient House of Black might object. How about Mr. Silver?
You get away from Mr. Gold, Ron said coldly, and took a step forward. He doesn't need to talk to the likes of you.
Harry raised a placating hand. I'll go by Mr. Bronze. Thanks for the naming schema. And Ron, Harry struggled to find a way to say this. I'm glad you're so enthusiastic about protecting me, but I don't particularly mind talking to Draco. This was apparently the last straw for Ron, who spun on Harry with eyes now aflame with outrage.
What? Do you know who this is?
Yes, Ron, Harry said. You may remember that I called him Draco without him needing to introduce himself. Draco sniggered. Then his eyes lit on the white owl on Ron's shoulder.
Oh, what's this? Draco said in a drawl rich with malice. Where is the famous Weasley family rat?
Buried in the backyard, Ron said coldly.
Aw, oh, how sad. Mr. Bronze, I should mention that the Weasley family is widely agreed to have the best pet story ever. Want to tell it, Weasley?
Ron's face contorted.
You wouldn't think it was funny if it happened to your family.
Oh, Draco purred, but it wouldn't ever happen to the Malfoys.
Ron's hands clenched into fists. That's enough, Harry said, putting as much quiet authority into the voice as he could manage. It was clear that whatever this was, it was a painful memory for the red-haired kid. If Ron doesn't want to talk about it, he doesn't have to talk about it, and I'd ask that you not talk about it either. Draco turned a surprised look on Harry, and Ron nodded.
That's right, Harry. I mean, Mr. Bronze. You see what kind of person he is? Now tell him to go away.
Harry counted to 10 inside his head, which for him was a very quick 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. An odd habit left over from the age of 5 when his mother had first instructed him to do it, and Harry had reasoned that his way was faster and ought to be just as effective.
Ron, Harry said calmly, I'm not telling him to go away. He's welcome to talk to me if he wants.
Well, I don't intend to hang around with anyone who hangs around with Draco Malfoy, Ron announced coldly.
Harry shrugged. That's up to you. I don't intend to let anyone say who I can and can't hang around with.
Silently chanting, Please go away. Please go away.
Ron's face went blank with surprise, like he'd actually expected that line to work. Then Ron spun around, yanked his luggage leash, and stormed off down the platform.
If you didn't like him, Draco said curiously, why didn't you just walk away?
His mother helped me figure out how to get to this platform from the King's Cross station, so it was kind of hard to tell him to get lost. And it's not that I hate this Ron guy, Harry said. I just... Harry searched for words.
Don't see any reason for him to exist, offered Draco.
Pretty much.
Anyway, Potter, if you really were raised by muggles...
Draco paused here, as if waiting for a denial, but Harry didn't say anything.
Then you may not realize what it's like to be famous. People are going to want to take up all of your time. You have to learn to say no.
Harry nodded, putting a thoughtful look on his face. That sounds like very good advice. If you try to be nice to them, it just means that you end up spending the most time around the most pushy ones. Decide who you want to spend time with and tell everyone else to go away. People will judge you by who they see you with, and you don't want to be seen with the likes of Ron Weasley. Harry nodded again. If you don't mind my asking, how did you recognize me? Mr. Bronze, Draco drawled. I have met you, remember? I met you very well indeed. I saw someone going around with a scarf wrapped around his head, looking absolutely ridiculous. So I took a wild guess. Harry bowed his head, accepting the compliment. I'm terribly sorry about that, Harry said. Our first meeting, I mean. I didn't mean to embarrass you in front of Lucius. Draco waved it off while giving Harry an odd look. I just wish Father could have come in while you were flattering me. Draco laughed. But thank you for what you said to Father. If not for that, I might have had a lot harder time explaining. Harry swept a deeper bow. And thank you for reciprocating with what you said to Professor McGonagall. You're welcome. The one of the assistants must have sworn her closest friend to absolute secrecy because Father says there's weird rumors going around, like you and I got in a fight or something. Ouch, said Harry, wincing. I'm really sorry. No, we're used to it. Merlin knows there's lots of rumors about the Malfoy family already. Harry nodded. Then I'm glad you're not in trouble. Draco smiled. Father has, a rather refined sense of humor, but he does understand making friends. He understands it very well. In fact, he made me repeat that before I went to bed every night for the last month. I will make friends at Hogwarts. When I explained everything to him and he saw that that's what I was doing, he not only apologized to me, but bought me an ice cream. Harry's jaw dropped. You managed to spin that into an ice cream? Draco nodded, looking every bit as smug as the feat deserved. Well, Father knew what I was doing, of course, but he's the one who taught me how to do it. And if I grin the right way while I'm doing it, that makes it a father-son thing, and then he has to buy me an ice cream, or I'll give him the sort of sad look like I think I must have disappointed him. Harry eyed Draco calculatingly, sensing the presence of another master. You've gotten lessons on how to manipulate people? For as far back as I can remember, Draco said proudly. Father bought me tutors. Wow, Harry said. Reading Robert Cialdini's Influence, Science and Practice probably didn't stack up very high compared to that, though it was still one heck of a book. Your dad is almost as awesome as my dad. Draco's eyebrows rose loftily. Oh? And what does your father do? He buys me books. Draco considered this. That doesn't sound very impressive. You had to be there. Anyway, I'm glad to hear all that. The way Lucius was looking at you, I thought maybe he was going to crucify you. My father really loves me, Draco said firmly. He wouldn't ever do that. Harry said. He remembered the black-robed, white-haired figure of perfection that had strolled into Madame Malkin's, wielding that beautiful, deadly, silver-handled cane. It was just so hard to visualize that perfect killer as a doting father. Don't take this the wrong way, but how do you know that? Huh? It was clear this was a question Draco did not commonly ask himself. I ask the fundamental question of rationality. Why do you believe what you believe? What do you think you know, and how do you think you know it? What have you seen which makes you think Lucius wouldn't sacrifice you the same way he'd sacrifice any other piece in his game? Draco shot Harry another odd look. Just what do you know about Father? Seat on the Wizengamot, seat on the Hogwarts Board of Governors, incredibly wealthy, has the ear of Minister Fudge, has the confidence of Minister Fudge, probably has some highly embarrassing photos of Minister Fudge, most prominent blood purist now that the Dark Lord's gone, former Inner Circle Death Eater who was found to have the Dark Mark but got off by claiming to be under the Imperius Curse, which was ridiculously implausible and pretty much everyone knew it. Evil with a capital E and a born killer. I think that's it. Draco's eyes had narrowed to slits. McGonagall told you that, did she? No, she wouldn't say anything to me about Lucius afterwards, except to stay away from him. So during the incident at the potions shop, while Professor McGonagall was busy talking to the shopkeeper and trying to get everything under control, I grabbed one of the customers and asked them about Lucius. Draco's eyes were wide again. Did you really? Harry gave Draco a puzzled look. If I lied the first time, I'm not going to tell you the truth just because you asked twice. There was a certain pause as Draco absorbed this. You're so completely going to be in Slytherin. I'm so completely going to be in Ravenclaw, thank you very much. I only want power so I can get books. Draco giggled. Yeah, right. Anyway, to answer what you asked,
Draco took a deep breath, and his face turned serious. Father once missed a Wizengamot vote for me. I was on a broom, and I fell off and broke a lot of ribs. It really hurt. I'd never hurt that much before, and I thought I was going to die. So Father missed this really important vote, because he was there by my bed at St. Mungo's, holding my hands and promising me I was going to be okay. Harry glanced away uncomfortably, then, with an effort, forced himself to look back at Draco. Why are you telling me that? It seems sort of private. Draco gave Harry a serious look. One of my tutors once said that people form close friendships by knowing private things about each other, and the reason most people don't make close friends is because they're too embarrassed to share anything really important about themselves. Draco turned his palms out invitingly. Your turn? Knowing that Draco's hopeful face had probably been drilled into him by months of practice did not make it any less effective, Harry observed. Actually, it did make it less effective, but unfortunately not ineffective. The same could be said of Draco's clever use of reciprocation pressure for an unsolicited gift, a technique which Harry had read about in his social psychology books. One experiment had shown that an unconditional gift of $5 was twice as effective as a conditional offer of $50 in getting people to fill out surveys. Draco had made an unsolicited gift of a confidence, and now invited Harry to offer a confidence in return. And the thing was, Harry did feel pressured. Refusal, Harry was certain, would be met with a look of sad disappointment and maybe a small amount of contempt indicating that Harry had lost points. Draco, Harry said, just so you know, I recognize exactly what you're doing right now. My own books called it reciprocation, and they talk about how giving someone a straight gift of 2 sickles was found to be twice as effective as offering them 20 sickles and getting them to do what you want. Harry trailed off. Draco was looking sad and disappointed. It's not meant as a trick, Harry. It's a real way of becoming friends. Harry held up a hand. I didn't say I wasn't going to respond. I just need time to pick something that's private, but just as non-damaging. Let's say I wanted you to know that I can't be rushed into things. A pause to reflect could go a long way in diffusing the power of a lot of compliance techniques, once you learn to recognize them for what they were. All right, said Draco. I'll wait while you come up with something. Oh, and please take off the scarf while you say it. Simple, but effective. And Harry couldn't help notice how clumsy, awkward, graceless his attempt at resisting manipulation slash saving face slash showing off had appeared compared to Draco. I need those tutors. All right, Harry said after a time. Here's mine. He glanced around and then rolled a scarf back up over his face, exposing everything but the scar. It sounds like you can really rely on your father. I mean, if you talk to him seriously, he'll always listen to you and take you seriously. Draco nodded. Sometimes, Harry said, and swallowed. This was surprisingly hard, but then it was meant to be. Sometimes I wish my own dad was like yours. Harry's eyes flinched away from Draco's face, more or less automatically, and then Harry forced himself to look back at Draco. Then it hit Harry what on earth he just said, and Harry hastily added, Not that I wish my dad was a flawless instrument of death like Lucius. I only mean taking me seriously. I understand, Draco said with a smile. There, now doesn't it feel like we're a little closer to being friends? Harry nodded. Yeah, it does, actually. No offense, but I'm going to put on my disguise again. I really don't want to deal with... I understand. Harry rolled a scarf back down over his face. My father takes all of his allies seriously, Draco said. That's why he has a lot of allies. Maybe you should meet him. I'll think about it, Harry said in a neutral voice. He shook his head in wonder. So you really are his one weak point. Huh. Now Draco was giving Harry a really odd look. You want to go get something to drink and find somewhere to sit down? Harry realized he had been standing in one place for too long and stretched himself, trying to crick his back. Sure. The platform was starting to fill up now, but there was still a quieter area on the far side away from the red steam engine. Along the way, they passed a vendor, a bald but bearded man with a small cart offering newspapers and comic books and stacked neon green cans. The vendor was, in fact, leaning back and drinking out of one of the neon green cans at the exact point when he spotted the refined and elegant Draco Malfoy approaching along with a mysterious boy looking incredibly stupid with a scarf tied over his face, causing the vendor to experience a sudden coughing fit in mid-drink and dribble a large amount of neon green liquid onto his beard. Excuse me, Harry said, but what is that stuff exactly?
Comed tea, said the vendor. If you drink it, something surprising is bound to happen which makes you spill it on yourself or someone else. But it's charmed to vanish just a few seconds later.
Indeed, the stain on his beard was already disappearing.
"How droll," said Draco. "How very, very droll. Come, Mr. Bronze, let's go find another..."
"Hold on," Harry said.
"Oh, come on! That's just juvenile."
"No, I'm sorry, Draco. I have to investigate this. What happens if I drink ComEd tea while doing my best to keep the conversation completely serious?" The vendor smiled and shrugged mysteriously. "Who knows? You suddenly see a friend walking by in a frog costume? Something humorous and unexpected will happen one way or another." "No, I'm sorry. I just don't believe it. That violates my much-abused suspension of disbelief on so many levels I don't even have the language to describe it. There is just no way a bloody drink can manipulate reality to produce comedy setups, or I'm going to give up and retire to the Bahamas."
Draco groaned. "Are we really going to do this?"
"You don't have to drink it, but I have to investigate. Have to. How much?"
5 knuts the can," the vendor said.
5 knuts? You can sell reality-manipulating soft drinks for 5 knuts the can?"
Harry reached into his pouch, said 4 sickles, 4 knuts, and slapped them down on the counter.
2 dozen cans, please.
End first half of chapter 7. The original text for this chapter can be found at fanfiction.net or by googling Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality, and there is also a link included in this file's description. If you enjoy this podcast, please help spread the word or leave a review at iTunes. If you're interested in learning more about the art of rationality, please visit LessWrong.com, an online community of aspiring rationalists founded by Eliezer Yudkowsky. Some sound effects used are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. A link to the attributions page is found in this file's description. The music used is Catch That Goblin by Skaven. Questions and comments can be sent to hpmorpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, and come back next week for the second half of Chapter 7, Reciprocation.